Thank you. All I want to do right now is introduce our moderator, who will introduce the panelists. Our moderator is a true expert in girls and secondary education. She was the chairwoman of the UN Millennium Task Force on Girls' Education and Gender Equity. She is the president and CEO of the Center for Global Development, a think tank in Washington focused solely on results-driven development throughout the world. And with that, I give you Nancy Birdsall.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists. From CAMFED, Ann Cotton. From the Forum for African Women Educationalists, Kodu Dow. Principal of the Rialto Day School, Sister Cyril. Founder and CEO of the African Institute of Learning, Sakina Yukaibi. And our moderator, President of the Center for Global Development, Nancy Birdsall.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you. And thank you for joining us in what promises to be an amazing session. We have four amazing women to tell you about what they're doing out there in the world on ensuring better access to girls' education. We all know, I'm an economist, we all know that girls' education is one of the best investments a household and a nation can make. The returns, social and economic, to girls' education exceed almost any other investment I can think of. That's true both with respect to higher wages and empowerment of women themselves, and of course it's true because so many women become mothers. And we know that better educated mothers produce or have better educated daughters and sons and healthier children, and they have the number of children that they and their husbands want. There are 60 million girls, 60 million, it's an astonishingly high number, right now today, out of school. Three quarters of those girls come from socially excluded groups, social minorities in their own countries. In Africa, only one of five girls even begins secondary school. So we know, those of us who study it from on top, you know, macro-like, that there are problems on the demand side and problems on the supply side. A lot of the attention goes, of course, to the supply side, how to make school systems better, how to ensure that teachers are trained, that books reach the schools. Donors have focused on that, and philanthropists have focused on those issues for years. There are also problems on the demand side. Why is it that parents don't send their girls to school? What are the factors, including future economic opportunities, that affect the decisions every day of girls and their parents of whether they'll continue in school? And we have, of course, the challenge of educational quality. How much does it matter whether girls actually learn something along with boys in school? So we have four fantastic people here who've thought about these issues and, more important, really worked on them and seen them from the bottom up. To hear from us, for you to hear from them. And what I'm going to do is ask each of them for just a moment or two to say something about... Oh, let me introduce them properly first. I'm sorry. Before we start talking, Sister Cyril on my far left. Sister Cyril has spent 50 years in Calcutta educating girls. For more than 30 years now, she's been the principal of a remarkable school in which one half of the girls come from poor slum families and one half from middle class and upper class families, the latter paying fees. It's a model that needs to be studied and understood. And disseminated in a sense. She does many other things around the school community that she'll tell you about. Next to Sister Cyril is Sakina Yakubi, who is the head of a group in Afghanistan that during the Taliban era ran, I think, had 8,000 girls at least in school, subsequently has worked in refugee camps to ensure that girls and boys have access to schooling, and today runs 30 or so learning centers that are concerned with providing services, I think, to over 300,000 women and girls in education and health. Next to Sakina is Ann Cotton. Have I got it right? Ann Cotton is the head of something called CAFED. Have I got that right? CAMFED, which is an organization that has been working on ensuring better access to education for girls in Africa for many years. And finally, we have next to her Kodu Diao, who is the new president of a very important group in Africa called FAWE, the Forum for African Education. African Women Educationalists. Kodu has a master's and a PhD in a program called something like Literacy, Learning, and Culture. It's was great at from the University of Maryland in Baltimore County, and has been. She's from Senegal, and I think has a big challenge in front of her in running FAWE. So what I'd like to do is ask each of our panelists to take just a minute or two to say one word about how you see your challenge, how you got into it, and perhaps comment on this point of demand and or supply. What do you see in the setting where you're operating as the key constraint? Starting with Sister Cyril, and then I am going to try to make this a conversation, so forgive me if I seem to sometimes interrupt.
Well, we've just highlighted a couple of things. One of them is the fact that teachers are very important. So one of our programs, all our programs run around the school. The school is the center. Extremely cost effective because every one of our secondary school girls from the age of 10 onwards becomes a teacher. And they handle the street children, the girls who live on the streets and who have no access and for whom school is not an option. All those kids are free to come into our school whenever they're free. Our gates are always open. And they will always find girls from the secondary school, as I say, from age 10 up to 17, free and ready to teach them in a program where every single child in my school has 2 periods per week set aside for this program. So they're free. It's built into their curriculum. And they learn how to teach. And these girls coming from the streets, within 1 year we can have an 11-year-old or a 12-year-old ready for the 5th or 6th class, according to our age group, in her own language, in Bengali. And in the process then, they pick up English along the way, but we don't delay them. That's one of the things. And then we have a huge program of, we've got about 27,000 kids in Calcutta who had no schools to go to at all. They are into centres run by 2 teachers, local unemployed but educated girls from those very slum areas, whom we have trained as teachers. So we have 27,000 kids with those as well. And plus we also have village programs, and we have hidden domestic child labour, where girls are sucked into families and parents are paid 200 rupees a month for them. They're fed and clothed, but in return they become virtual slaves. And no one can get at them. But our children who live next door to them, they know who they are, and they manage to get them out.
Let me ask you a quick question. These young girls who both are learning and also provide teaching,
yes,
for others, has the city of Calcutta or the state observed this and thought about incorporating your approach into the formal schools?
It has spread to other schools. I'm still struggling a little bit with the state, but now we have another program called Human Rights Education, which the state has taken on, and through which now we hope to make an entry into the other schools with these programs as part of the human rights education.
Terrific.
So that has been taken.
Thank you.
Anyway, first of all, I would like to thank CG, Clinton CG initiative, because really it's a great opportunity for us as an NGO to be here. And we are really also honored to be here because we have such wonderful people and community like you to support us and the work that we do, because without you, we will not be able to do the work we are doing. It. And that's, I really wanted to, from the bottom of my heart, to thank every one of you. What is the reason that we do the work that we are doing? I am trying to educate the girls in Afghanistan right now, the girls that really are not able to get education. We are reaching to the community, to villages that there are not schools around this area. And what kind of program do we provide for these girls? We provide program from literacy to income generation, to health education, and to skill training, all kinds of things in one center. The government of Afghanistan right now supporting all the school. So, but what is our job? Our job is to try to open this center that it will be available for the people, for girls who are 18, 20, 21 years old who have not been in school. We design program for them that according to their own speed, they can learn in those centers. And also we are there for them that they can come with their children. While they have a baby in their arm, they can learn. And also, we are trying to give them a health education that they will be a healthier mother. As you know, we really believe that education is the key issue for getting transformation through social, economic, and also health. In this, education is the key issue for Afghanistan, especially a country who has been 30 years in war. And also, the girls and the women has been the victim of war in Afghanistan. You know, in Afghanistan right now, we don't have that many schools. Yes, we have 5 million children are going to school, but the schools are not there. But also the quality education. The quality education is very, very important to Afghanistan. We could have a school, as somebody before pointed out, that hundreds of students can go to school, but if there is not a quality school, then the students will run away back from school. They are not going to stay in school.
So, and Sakina, I want to ask you a question, and it's related to something you were saying, and you told me beforehand. The environment has gotten more difficult in Afghanistan in the last couple of years than it was immediately after the war. Could you say something about whether and how, what you do if that begins to lead to a reduction in the ability of girls to actually come to your centers?
Thank you very much. I really think that security is the biggest issue in Afghanistan. All of you know about the security in Afghanistan, what is going on. And prior to 2 years ago, Afghanistan was in a much better situation that the girls could go to school. Right now also the girls are coming to school because the people of Afghanistan love education. Believe me, in every village, in every city that we go, everyone wants their children to go to school. Although they know that their life is in risk, although they know that their children will be maybe kidnapped, but the issue is that if there is a quality education, they will stay in school. Although they risk their life, but the quality education must be there. Quality education means teacher training. We must have trained teacher. We must have innovative teacher. We must have a teacher who can relate to the children. We must have a teacher who is from the community. We must have a teacher that trusted us. We must choose a community that trusts us.
You can see why Sakina is successful in getting stuff done.
I really mean it. That is the community. You don't have to go impose on the community. Community is coming to you.
Okay,
I have hundreds of schools who are coming in requesting program from me. The reason is that because through 18 years of work from refugee camp to now, we have been building trust between the community. And they come, and by the trust, they know that the program is theirs, not ours. They tell us what they want, and we listen to them. And we design material, design program according to their needs. Thank you.
You're welcome. You can see these are ferocious people about what they are doing. Anne.
Well, I want to pick up your theme, Sakina, in terms of the demand for education, because I started my work in 1991 when I went out to a rural village in Zimbabwe. And what I found really challenged the conventional wisdom that there was a resistance to the education of girls on the part of parents. Not so. That wasn't what I heard. I heard that there was an absolute desire for education among parents. You know, it doesn't really make sense that there's an economic line below which parents don't care about the future and care and education of their children, whether boys or girls. And so I really wanted to challenge that and set out on, at a practical level, to put in place a program that actually showed that there was a desire and a demand for education. But I think that word demand is really, when we're talking about very, very poor communities, a misnomer. They actually don't have a sense of demand. They don't know and understand their entitlement, even to those resources that are raised in their name. And I think one of the big issues around girls' education is the transparency and accountability. On the supply side, you know, there are many bursary schemes that are actually targeting girls. But when the gift of education is actually misapplied, when it's in the hands of an individual to give the gift of education, then we're actually putting girls in a dangerous situation where there can be an abuse of money and an abuse of power through sexual power. And I think we have to take on board that very, very serious gender issue, the reality that girls are 3 to 5 times more likely to be HIV positive in Africa than boys. Why? Because of their acute sexual vulnerability. So schemes and programs have to be designed with that in mind. Parents have to know what the entitlement of their daughters is. They have to then ensure that they get that entitlement. Organizations have to put in place a very transparent and accountable system that enables everyone in the community to understand what's going on. At a meeting with Gordon Brown, that we had brought over some young women from Ghana who'd gone through our program, and one of them looked at the Prime Minister and said, "Do you know that when you go to a school and you see that the most beautiful girl has the educational bursary, then you know it's because she's sleeping with the headmaster." And Gordon Brown visibly blanched at that point. So bursary schemes, yes, on the demand side, providing to the demand and around supply. But that intersection of demand and supply is really putting girls in very serious danger. And we have to be acutely responsible for them.
Thank you very much, Anne. Now to Kotu, who actually, I think, very good. This issue of the environment, both at the time girls are going to school and subsequently when they leave school, whether there is pressure for them to marry, for example, which might be the case in South Asia, and whether there is pressure at the when they're in school in terms of sexual favors, the risk of abuse. I wonder if that's something that Fawei has thought about, if you could incorporate into whatever you want to say about your challenges. Any thoughts on that tough issue?
Thank you, Anne. Fawei takes care both of the demand side and the supply side, and also does a lot of advocacy for at the level of policy with educational policy, education policy maker, to actually incorporate gender-responsive approaches within the plan, education plans. But within the schools, Fawei also has a very holistic approach to girls' education, whereby we look at the physical aspect of the school, at the social aspect of education or educating girls, and also the academic aspect. So we believe at Fawei that girls' education is a complex, and you cannot take care of one dimension while leaving another. And that's why Fawei has developed a model called the Gender Responsive School, now dubbed the Center of Excellence. And this model has been tried first in 4 countries, Senegal, Kenya, Tanzania, and Rwanda, and now is expanding into other countries. Now we are at 12 countries where the gender-responsive school takes care of gender-responsive pedagogy by training teachers into being more aware of active methods, but also gender-based methods, where both the needs of girls and boys are taken into account.
This is great. I want to interrupt just to give you an opportunity to say something about, since you're working through FAWE at the policy level to transform systems, is there something you could say about this issue of lack of access to secondary school, the extent to which it minimizes or reduces the ability and the interest in girls finishing primary school? Just a word on that very quickly, because I want to go back to... Okay.
That's where I was going to lead, because the program we have is both at primary and secondary level. And we not only provide bursaries, but we make sure that girls who are in the schools with the bursaries are able to study well, not being harassed by teachers or members, males in the community, that the girls perform well in, let's say, math and science and technology subjects, that they also have gender-aware materials. So this whole compound makes it a more conducive environment for the girls to study. But for secondary school level, we have a key program called Tuseme, which is which means let's speak out in Swahili.
Lovely.
And this program is a girls' empowerment program that also incorporates boys in mixed schools. And this program uses theater.
Okay, but I have to stop you because I can see the clock and it's really...
Okay.
They're very disciplined at the Clinton Global Initiative, which is for all our benefit. What I want to do is ask each of you to comment on this issue. Girls' education has to be embedded in the larger environment of opportunity for women and girls after school. How does that affect, or how do you think about that in the context of the tremendous work that each of you is doing, starting with Sister Cyril? And try to be quick, because time is...
Well, you see, our whole idea, as Loreto Sisters in Calcutta, we also have a degree college, we have a commercial college, we have a technology college. So when they come up through our system and emerge at the top, they already have a job.
So they know they have an opportunity.
And that's no doubt key.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this whole business of access and the whole business of quality of education, we're doing that through the teacher training and trying to spread that out then into other areas. And remember that half the world's children that are not in school are Indian children.
We talk
about 60 million girls.
That's a good factoid.
That's a very important thing for us to remember.
Sakina.
In Afghanistan, especially that 44 center that we are operating in it, in each center we have designed a program that the students come and learn in their own speed. As they promote to higher level and higher level, they can integrate to the public school, or if they are not integrating into public school, they can have a job, because we have a job skill training for them, and they can go and have a job and, for example, income generation, if they are willing to do that, or carpet weaving, or beautician, or they can go to, if they are in a higher level of education, they can learn computer skill, they can learn English skill, they can go and be somebody that they want
to.
So
you feel they have good opportunities?
Absolutely.
At least you're the girls who benefit from your program.
Absolutely. That's the reason we're operating a women's center, because it gives them the opportunity to be trained and to have a job. You know, in Afghanistan right now, the economy is so bad and the people are so poor that there is no job available, and the government also doesn't have the capacity, because it's 30 years of war. It's not overnight. It's a long-term process, and for long-term process, that is EIL is trying to create an environment, a secure environment for the girls who are 20, 21 years old to come and learn this skill and be able to have a job. In Afghanistan...
Okay, so I have to make you... but I hope that all of you who are interested in the incredible work of each individual will talk to them afterwards. Seek them out. Anne.
Thank you. Well, I mean, it's absolutely true. The socio-economic environment when girls leave school is one that is fraught with danger for them. If they're in a rural environment, then the likelihood is that they go to town in search of non-existent jobs or jobs that are thinly disguised as prostitution work in the hotel industry or domestic service. And so in 1998, after we'd been working for 5 years, we realized that what we needed was the rural regeneration. And so across 4 countries, what we've created is a network of alumni. If a Harvard can have an alumni, why not rural girls in Africa?
Lovely.
So
okay.
This is a pan-African network now.
That's
and
fantastic.
They are the ones that are driving change.
Thank you.
FAWE operates in 32 countries, and each country has its specificities. But in general, we take care of both the social environment, and we link up with communities so that girls outside the schools are able to benefit from what they learn and also transmit to the community so that they support their education. In some countries, we also have vocational and training. Not many, but we are moving towards that because especially in conflict situation or post-conflict situations where girls are not able to go into the formal school system. So the linkages with the socio-cultural environment is made mostly in the post-conflict situations.
I hope all of you are as frustrated as I am at how little time we had to hear about such an important issue and such innovation and deep thinking about all sides from our 4 panelists. I think now Jean Sperling comes up and tells us what to do next. Could you all thank the panelists?
Well, the good news is that you get a chance to hear from them again. And the way that we do this is that you will have a table conversation. What you're talking about will be being recorded, and so that the people over there are going to know what are the themes that will be coming up. And this will give then Nancy a chance to take whatever your issues or concerns are and give these amazing 4 women another chance to respond to what you are thinking. The question that we have, well, first of all, just to show that we are interactive here, there were some people who are saying they were having trouble. They didn't quite get the ID of our 3rd and 4th panelists. So just to be clear, if you didn't, Ann Cotton from CAMFED, which started in Zambia. Yes? Zimbabwe, excuse me. And Kodu Dao is the FAWE. Those of us who work in this area, just think of it FAWE, F-A-W-E, but the Federation for African Women for Education. They are not one of, they are the major federation of African Women for Education. We could not have done this panel without them. So in terms of the question, and just to be very transparent, in the last couple of years, some of the way the question was often, what can you do? Because this is Clinton Global Initiative, and you're supposed to be asking what kind of action can we have. And people felt that was a little unfair to kind of put people on the spot. And so we don't want to do that, but we want to keep the action focus. So what we want to know is, what are the few key things that can be done to address the challenges you heard today, and by whom and how? It doesn't necessarily have to be by yourself, but we believe that if you're asking the question and asking the who can do it question, it will lead to collaboration and inspiration among people here. So you now have a very, very talented and expert group of table facilitators. So enjoy your discussion, which will again be too short, but we'll have a chance to hear from our panelists again. Thank you.